Is the world running out of food?
Unless we figure out either how to end climate change or farm in a radically different way, then millions upon hundreds of millions of people are going to be in a very, very dire straits.
That's Joel K. Born. We talk with him about overpopulation, the threat of famine, and new ways to feed a crowded world. His book is The End of Plenty. That's coming up this hour on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When food riots erupted around the world in 2007 and then again in 2011, it heralded the end of the so-called Green Revolution. That was supposed to make food scarcity a thing of the past. But a perfect storm is developing that threatens our food supply now and for generations to come, unless we make big changes fast. Climate change could turn half the world's arable land into desert by century's end. Pollution and overuse add to the impact of climate-driven drought on water supplies. Chemical agriculture is poisoning the land, rendering insects and weeds ever more resistant. Food insecurity leads to wars and unrest, like in Syria and Somalia. Refugee populations swell as farming and urban communities fall apart. And looming over all is an exploding world population that could go from its current 7 billion to more than 9 billion by 2050. We may already have passed peak food. My guest, environmental journalist Joel K. Born, takes a hard look at our food supply and the perfect storm bearing down on it. But he also sees room for hope in new ways of farming that increase yields while protecting the planet. The only question is, will we put them in place in time? Joel Born is an award-winning journalist and former senior editor for the environment for National Geographic. His work has also appeared in Audubon, Science, and Outside Magazine. He got a degree in agronomy before becoming a journalist. Joel Born, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to be here.
This book is about the race to feed the world, you say at one point in this book, to feed the world without ending it. Without ending it?
Yeah, it's pretty dramatic. One of the inspirations for writing this book was a study that came out from the Royal Society in London a few years ago that really looked at how we're going to feed everyone and farm through this century of climate change. And according to their projections, they did a broad review of climate change studies as well as how it might affect agriculture around the world. And they said if we hit a 4 degrees Celsius increase, which our emissions are currently on track to provide us, then we could take half of our agricultural land and make it either less suited or unsuitable for agriculture by century's end. This is 2100 when the world population at that point is projected to hit 11.2 billion people, according to the United Nations. So when I saw that figure, I thought, you know what? We can't get there from here. The numbers just don't add up. We're increasingly struggling to feed the people we have on the planet now with our current grain production. And we're seeing more and more extreme events like droughts and heat waves that are pounding our productivity in many of our most prolific bread baskets. So it seemed to me the writing was on the wall. And unless we figure out either how to end climate change or farm in a radically different way, then millions upon hundreds of millions of people are going to be in a very, very dire straits.
Now, you came from a farm family yourself. Tell us a little bit about how farming changed on your family's farm from the time that your grandfather had it to when your father did.
My grandfather purchased his farm in the 1930s, around the time of Depression. He bought it from a cousin who was going bankrupt, and he had no intention of actually farming himself. He was a small-town attorney and was just sort of helping a relative out. But he loved the farm and was very involved in it and farmed on shares with two farmers who farmed it for most of his life. And my grandfather was a quail hunter. That was what he loved to do. So the farm, for those of you who don't know about quail or hunting, quails like things messy and weedy. They spend a lot of time in the hedgerows and around the brush around the fields. And even though it's not the best conditions for farming, it's great for wildlife. And that's what my grandfather was very interested in. But when he passed away, my father, who had also farmed a little bit after World War II, became the manager of the farm. And he was very much invested in the Green Revolution. He came throughout that period when Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. And that was about the time my father took over. This was also the time Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture during the Nixon administration. And was, you know, we had just made this huge grain sale to Russia. It reaped an enormous amount of money for U.S. coffers. And so the word out to America's farmers was plant fence row to fence row. We're going to feed the world. And so my father spent most of his career and most of his life cleaning up the farm, making it very neat, making it very efficient, you know, really following in the paradigm of Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution with high-yielding crops and a lot of fertilizers and a lot of pesticides. So I grew up on the farm as my playground. I played on it as a kid. I drove tractors long before I learned how to drive a bike. And spent most of my childhood just working and playing on the farm. So when it came time for me to go to college, that's all I wanted to be. I thought that was my destiny, to be a farmer in Edgecombe County, North Carolina. So I applied to NC State University, one of the great bastions of the Green Revolution, and started studying scientific agriculture. But about my second or third year, I really started to have misgivings about the type of agriculture that was being taught there. It seemed like we were doing little more than learning how to calibrate sprayers and pick the next best pesticide. And when I would ask my advisors, well, what about this organic agriculture that was starting to make inroads even as early as the 1980s? And they would just laugh it off as, you know, great for your garden, but it'll never feed the world. Don't even bother with it. They were just completely dismissive of it. So I grew more and more estranged from sort of the conventional paradigm of modern agriculture until finally I said, I graduated in the middle of the farm crisis in 1985 when Willie Nelson and Neil Young and John Mellencamp were starting concerts to aid farmers that were going out of business. And I kept seeing the best farmers in my county, the men that I looked up to and respected, going bankrupt. And I thought, man, this is not the future for me. So I had always loved writing and journalism. And I thought, well, I'll give this a shot and see how it goes. And here I am 30 years later, still writing about it. And this book gave me an opportunity to sort of merge both of those loves and both of those concerns.
And it does a terrific job in that you really lay out kind of the choice between these two paradigms, but not in a way that is, you know, ideologically driven, but that really looks at the evidence. Before we get into the paradigm of chemical agriculture and or versus the paradigm of organic agriculture, let's talk about where we are right now. Global population is trending toward 10 billion by 2050, possibly even more. Some scientists, like James Lovelock, for example, have estimated that the carrying capacity of the Earth is only 2 billion. So we're already way beyond that, pushing 7 billion. You spend some time talking about Malthus, Thomas Robert Malthus. His predictions were considered quite discredited in the 20th century. Talk a little bit about what he predicted, and why did it seem that he was so wrong?
When I started this project, I was like most people. I was taught, you know, Malthus was wrong in every case. Everything he said, everything he predicted, just wrong, wrong, wrong. But of course, I, like most people, had never actually read it. So I went over, I was on a reporting trip to the United Kingdom and stopped by the British Library and picked up Malthus's first edition. Started reading it and found it incredibly easy to grasp. And, you know, it was still in that sort of 1798 language. But the more I read, I realized that, you know, he wasn't predicting that the world was going to come to an end with some great famine and global population collapse. Really, he was focused on why populations didn't collapse. And he spent his entire career trying to figure out what were the pressures on human population and, you know, basically how they related to the poor, where most of the pressures were felt. And so in his original essay, which was very youthful, he was young, he was sort of in an argument with his father. So he was making this sort of polemic against some of the more popular writers of the day who thought, you know, that the world was just going to get better and better and better and everything was going to go great. So in his original book, he said, well, no, population has a tendency to grow exponentially, whereas agriculture only has the potential to grow arithmetically. And the difference in the two powers should be evident to anyone that population could easily outrun agriculture. And therefore, population will always be limited by our ability to produce food for ourselves. So this was his sort of major population theory. And what happened, of course, was he was writing in the middle of the Industrial Revolution, or right at the beginning, actually. So he had no idea how, you know, tapping into millions of years of energy stored in coal or in later oil and gas would transform our economy from one that was very organic, very wood-based, you know, steam-based, to one that was coal-based and fossil fuel-based. He certainly had no idea about the great British agricultural revolution that occurred in the mid-1800s or the one that followed in the United States and around the world during the mid-1900s that would just so expand our agricultural production that we could far and away keep up with population growth. But as we go and look back at his legacy, we see now that these pressures that he talked about, the ability of people to consume more and produce more people than we can keep up with in ag, has come back to bite us several times. It came back in the early 1900s when there was a wheat scare and they didn't think there was enough wheat for the world. It certainly came back in the 1960s when the neo-Malthusians like Paul Ehrlich and Club of Rome really did predict famines that were going to hit in the 1970s that didn't occur. And so here we are once again at the turn of the century, where we're starting to see demand from both population growth, increased wealth, and increased use of grains for industrial uses like biofuels, really starting to slowly outstrip our production and drawing down our stockpiles to some of the lowest levels we've seen since the 1970s, when about a quarter of the world was hungry, was desperately hungry. And when you talk to researchers now, who have studied this issue quite closely, because this is the issue around the world, they say we are now going to have to double our grain production, 70 to 110% by 2050, in order to just make sure the status quo is maintained. And of course, we still have 800 million people that are hungry. We still have a billion or 2 billion people. Actually, it's 2 billion people who suffer from nutrient deficiencies that cause them ill health. So we still have a long way to go to solving the hunger problem.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about the threats to the world's food supply, climate change, overpopulation, pollution, and more. Our guest this hour is Joel Born. His book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World, out from W.W. Norton.
So you say double the grain production. Let's unpack that idea for a minute. For example, you talk about the food riots of 2007-2008. You write that there was actually a record grain harvest in 2007. So why did food prices go up? I mean, the food riots were around the incredible increase in grain prices. If it's just an issue of yield, if it's just an issue of how much we produce, then why did we have that problem?
Well, it was really interesting. And 2007-2008 was really a wake-up call for the planet. That's when the price of wheat and maize tripled. The price of rice increased fivefold on the world market. It was a dramatic price shock that sent 100 million more people into poverty around the world. Now, what happened was really interesting. Most years, the world's farmers produce enough grain. And here we're talking about just three basic staple grains, maize, rice, and wheat, that provide 80 to 90% of all the calories we consume, either directly or indirectly through animal feeds. Incredibly important crops. So up until most decades, we'll produce more, or we'll use more than we produce. Like in the 70s, it was probably 3 years we were short. And we had 7 years where we produced more than we used. The 80s were fairly dry, so we had 4 years where we didn't produce quite enough. And again, this is winnowing down the stockpiles, because we always have carryover crops from 1 year to the next. The 90s, it went down to about 3 years that we didn't produce as much as we consumed. But since 2000, we started either consuming or utilizing for biofuels more grain than we produced in 8 of the first 12 years. And this brought our stockpiles down to the lowest levels they've been since the 1970s. And that's what drove this enormous run-up in prices that occurred in 2007-2008. One of the other factors, and I mentioned these two in our book, was the incredible run-up in the oil prices, because a lot of these, our agriculture is very oil-dependent now, very energy-dependent, as well as the role that large institutional speculators play in the agricultural grain markets when they just went in mass after the fall of the real estate bubble. And started investing in mass in agriculture because they saw these grain prices going. They saw demand outstripping supply, and they saw there's a price signal. We're going to make some money. And they did, hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars at the expense of very poor, very hungry people around the world. So it was like the perfect storm of grain prices in 2007, 2008, even though the world's farmers had hit near record production. So that was when most of the agricultural experts really said, whoa, we've got a big problem here that we're going to have to deal with. Many of them had been talking about it literally since the mid-1990s when Lester Brown first talked about who's going to feed China, who's going to feed this burgeoning economy where people are moving into the middle class, eating more meat, who's going to feed them, who's going to feed their pigs. So this question had been around, but it hadn't really evidenced itself in the market until 2007, 2008. And then we saw it hit again in 2010. We saw it hit again in 2012. 2010 led to the Arab Spring, or helped drive some of the frustration that was occurring in that region. And of course, 2012 was the incredible droughts we had in the United States and Australia that took a climate hit to agricultural production. So, these are the things that led up to what we now see as this great food crisis ahead of us.
So you're talking about really a lot of competition for the harvest itself, competition for land and competition for water, competition for all the resources and the inputs, as well as speculation, commodity speculation. Different people, different groups point the finger at others. The people who were doing biofuels were pointing the finger at the commodity speculators, and vice versa. Do these all just interact with each other, or are there some of them that are more important than others?
Oh, sure. Of course, the classic driver of demand, of course, is population growth. So the world has roughly 80 million more mouths to feed each year. And as you mentioned, the latest UN projections had us, mid-range projections had us hitting 9.6 billion people by 2050. So that in itself, everybody who gets born needs to be fed. And that in itself is sort of the annual increase that we have to be producing. Now, on top of that, we're getting richer as well. So places like India and China, where the middle class is just burgeoning, those countries usually eat very low on the food chain, very modest, very little amounts of meat, mostly vegetables, mostly staples, rice and wheat. But as they move into the cities, in China in particular, and start working in the factories, they start eating more meat. And we saw Chinese per capita meat consumption double in the last decade. And this has enormous consequences for grain around the world. China can no longer grow enough grain to feed both its people and its 600 million hogs. So they have to go on the world market to buy feed for the hogs, and they did that through soybeans, the soybean revolution that rolled into Latin America. So Brazil and China now have one of the largest trade flows, agricultural trade flows in the world, of soybeans being produced in Brazil going into China. So you know, the rising income and population are the two big factors that are increasing demand. Now, biofuels is the new one. Suddenly, we've gone from making using our all this grain for food and for feeding animals and livestock, which eventually feed people. Now we're feeding it to our automobiles. And of course, in the United States, which is the Saudi Arabia of corn, we now put 40% of our corn crop directly into our gas tanks via ethanol. A tremendous amount of land, energy, fertilizer, pesticide going directly into our gas tank to produce a fuel that has very little environmental benefits, that, you know, causes a 20% reduction in our fuel economy. But, you know, it certainly is stuff we grow here at home and not stuff we have, not energy we have to import from overseas. So there are certainly some benefits, but it's enormous. It takes up an enormous swath of arable land in the United States. In Europe, we're looking at, they're hoping to go to 20% of their diesel fuel, diesel transportation fuel, in the next decade or so, which is tremendous. Their goal of 10% already is now taking about 10 to 15% of their arable land in Europe. We're talking 17 million hectares of land devoted to growing crops specifically for diesel, for petroleum oil. And that has also had repercussions in places like Malaysia or Indonesia, where you're taking out huge swaths of native rainforest to grow palm oil. Now, palm oil is a great crop for producing biofuel, but when you displace native rainforest, the carbon footprint just goes through the roof. And so this is part of our big challenge, is that not only do we have to feed people, but our agriculture as we currently practice it produces a third of all global emissions every year. So this is where I get to the point where we are literally farming ourselves out of food the way we're currently practicing agriculture and feeding ourselves. And that is unsustainable. We just cannot continue in this path.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Joel Bourne about his terrific book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. You know, one of the things that surprised me when I was reading this section about biofuels was how biofuel production doesn't only increase the price of corn, but it increases the price of all agricultural commodities. Connect the dots for us.
Yeah, there's a real knock-on effect when it comes to biofuels. It's kind of like a domino effect. So when we take all that land that we're now planting more land in corn than we've ever planted before, just record amount of acreage, that means we don't plant as much soybeans or we don't plant as much wheat. You know, and that sort of causes those prices to rise because you reduce the amount of land and production that the United States would do. Europe is the same thing. A lot of the oilseed crops that they're producing for their biodiesel are on lands that are typically wheat lands. So when they start growing sunflower or canola or something that displaces wheat, you wouldn't think that would have such a big deal. Like in one study I cite, the wheat acreage actually went down by like 1%. That was it, 1% in 2007, 2008. But what that did was cause wheat to skyrocket to the highest inflation-adjusted prices it's been since World War I. This was a tremendous boost. And, of course, the biofuel producers were very quick to point the fingers elsewhere. But, again, it's this displacement value. When you have one crop where the price goes up, it tends to bring the cost of other crops up. Rice is far too important to brew into biofuel. It feeds half the planet the bulk of their calories. And yet, even though there was no change in rice production during those years in 2007, 2008, the price of rice still skyrocketed because it was a substitution for wheat in many areas. And so it became this just knock-on effect that was quite dramatic. And so now what we find is all our food prices are linked because of this connection with biofuels and this displacement. We've been very fortunate in the recent years that oil prices have been low. But as soon as oil prices get up above 80 or 90 or, you know, $80 a barrel, I think is the break-even price for ethanol without subsidies, then suddenly the price of grain rises and falls with the price of oil. So it's a very complicated relationship, but one that is many economists have been studying hard and trying to find how to disconnect these two. And many who are concerned about global poverty and global hunger have said, we have to do it. We have to disconnect this. We have to get off grain and food-based biofuels. It's just not sustainable.
Then, of course, this connects to the whole idea of commodity speculation as a driver of price rise as well. Because if the prices are going up, this becomes more attractive. This didn't happen for a long time because there was regulation of the commodity market. Talk about what that regulation was and then what got deregulated.
Sure. After the great crash of 1929 that sent the world into the worst depression it had ever been in, the worst economic depression, few people realized that that crash was largely driven by wheat speculators, right? The price of wheat got really high in the 1920s. Everybody and their brother was trying to grow wheat out in the Midwest. They were growing it from offices in Chicago. It was very, it was a boom time for wheat. And when that bubble burst in the great crash of 29, the federal government stepped in and said, we're no longer, these commodities, these staple grains are too important to our people and the world economy to play with as pawns on the market. So we're going to put position limits in place. And this was a law that came into act in 1930. It was called the Commodities – I can't remember the exact name of it – Commodity and Securities Exchange Act of 1930. I've written in the book. I'm afraid I can't bring it up by name. So that was in place up until the end of the Clinton administration, right as Bill Clinton was going out of office at the end of the 1990s and George Bush was coming in. There was a huge push amongst Congress to deregulate the financial industry, and this was part of the deal. They had the Commodities Trading Modernization Act that was passed, and I think it was finally passed in 2001, which suddenly reduced, certainly allowed large speculators like Goldman Sachs, Barclays, these huge banks and huge investment banks, to suddenly move into the commodity trading without limits. And they were doing this in markets that were not regulated. Part of the housing bubble was the derivative market that crashed, that was completely unregulated and off the books. Well, the commodities were the same way. And so what we saw as commodity prices started to rise was speculators really starting to get in there en masse, and as oil prices started to rise as well. So just one example, in the spring of 2012, just 3 years ago, large financial speculators like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Barclays Capital over in the UK owned 61% of the futures market for all the world's wheat. 61% by three large investors of the world's wheat. So, even though they weren't actually cornering the market, but 60% is an enormous amount. This is not typical speculation or what they call useful speculation, where you're a large baker and you need wheat. So you buy it on contract earlier in the year to make your prices stable, and the farmers who provide the wheat do the same. That's sort of traditional speculation that's always been going on that people think are good for the market, creates stable prices for everyone. This is just pure gambling. And in many cases, states in the United States had to amend their gambling laws to allow some of this trading to occur without having these large institutions break state gambling laws. So it's just absolutely absurd that we allow companies like this to gamble with our food and with the world's food. So what I've said in the book is that suddenly the 800 to a billion people who can't get enough calories in the world are now competing for wheat and rice and maize with the wolves of Wall Street and the giant biofuels industry. And it's just, it's uncanny that it's been allowed to do this.
And if they've cornered the market, does that mean that they can actually control the price to some degree?
Well, if they own all the wheat in the world, they certainly could, I would think. Then everybody has to go to them to start to buy the wheat they need. Now, it's very difficult to corner a market, as you know. As prices start to rise, everybody else jumps in. But my point is, why are we allowing them to do that anyway? This is incredibly important. These are incredibly important commodities. This is not gold. This is not iron ore. These are things that cause people great distress when the prices rise. And so, the Obama administration has tried to limit these positions with the Dodd-Frank Banking Reform Act. And these are the exact limits that the banks have completely dug their heels on and have launched a slew of lawsuits to try to stop. It has not yet been resolved. It is still working its way through the courts. But there is an effort to reform this part of the law.
Joel Bourne. His book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. After the break, we'll talk about some promising new ways farmers around the world are increasing food production sustainably. Stick around.
I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. No, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. Well, I wake up in the morning, hold my hands and pray for rain. I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. It's a shame the way she makes me scrub the floor. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. No, I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more. Well, he hands you a nickel, he hands you a dime. He asks you with a grin if you're having a good time. And he finds you every time you slam the door. I ain't gonna work for Maggie's brother no more.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on other stations around the country, and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about the very real possibility that the world is running out of food. Climate change, biofuels, and even financial speculation are crimping food supplies while demand continues to skyrocket in a more crowded and affluent world. But my guest this hour, journalist Joel Bourne, says the situation is not hopeless. Farmers and researchers are finding ways to increase yields while protecting people and the planet.
Now, you've talked in this book, The End of Plenty, Joel Bourne, of an agricultural Armageddon that we're basically staring down. And, you know, we're getting the picture now of some of the different factors that are involved. One of those factors is what you call peak grain. And I thought the Green Revolution, and I think many of us thought that the Green Revolution was supposed to basically make yields of grain and the other staple crops go up basically forever. What's happened with the Green Revolution and what's peak grain? Have we hit that yet?
Yes, actually we had. We hit it in 1986, oddly enough. And of course, you know, it was interesting. I was an editor of Geographic when many of the environmental writers were talking about peak oil in the early 2000s. Oh, we're going to have peak oil. We're going to run out of this fossil fuel. It's going to be incredibly dear. The prices are going to go up. And of course, then we had ultra deep water drilling and we had fracking. And suddenly the world was awash in oil and gas. Prices are now lower than they've been in a decade. And what we found out that with oil, it just depends on the price, how much availability it is. There's a lot of $100 barrel oil out there for us to get. Grain, however, is a totally different thing. So one of the research papers I looked at really looked at this factor of the amount of grain, total grain we grow worldwide per capita. And they found that the world hit peak grain, producing roughly 370 kilograms per person in 1986. Every year since then, it's been going down. By 2009, it was down to 350 kilograms per person. And if the current trends continue, they say that number will reach 327 kilograms per person by 2030. And this was the same amount produced during the late 1960s when nearly a quarter of the world's population suffered from chronic hunger and Paul Ehrlich at Stanford and everyone else was predicting these massive famines. So because the Green Revolution has stalled, it has absolutely flatlined, particularly for wheat and rice. We are no longer seeing yield gains in those crops and haven't since around the turn of the century. And population growth continues to grow. It means that we are producing less grain per capita every year. And this is what the concept of pink grain was all about. Now, what's interesting to me and fascinating, I was not a big Norman Borlaug fan when I started this book, but I became to begrudgingly respect his honesty and his integrity and his general humanity. And what a visionary the guy turned out to be. When he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for his work in almost tripling grain yields from about, well, this was over the course of the Green Revolution, but from the 1940s or 50s until, let's say, the late 1980s, he said in 1970, the Green Revolution is going to give us 30 years. We have 30 years of breathing room before it plays out, and unless we get what he termed the population monster under control, we'll be right back where we were. And sure enough, in 2000, almost on the dot, grain yield increases started to flag and they started to stagnate. And we've seen no increase in them ever since. Part of that, of course, was that we took our eye off the ball. We stopped investing in basic agricultural research, which was the prime driver of yield growth. Wasn't GMOs, wasn't organics, it wasn't any fancy thing. It was just plain basic agricultural research, foundation stock, improving our seed stock, improving our agronomy. And by the 1980s, when we were washing grain, we thought, why bother? We've solved the world grain crisis. We don't need to spend money doing that anymore. The number of wheat researchers in the late 2010s, when we had this outbreak of wheat rust in Africa that was so threatens our global grain crop, our rust researchers in the United States had dwindled down to two. We had two people in the United States working on wheat rust, which was a scourge of this crop before Borlaug found a resistant gene to it. So we really took our eyes off the ball and stopped investing in our agriculture. And that's part of why we're in the fix that we're currently in.
But it's not all gloom and doom. And in fact, you point to some kinds of practices that are now being used that are actually increasing yields, yields of rice, yields of wheat and grain. You know, I think this book is so important from the point of view of being a warning, but also of holding out hope if we can turn around how we do farming. I'll ask you about organics in a minute, but talk also about what are some of the ways in which yields are actually being increased by using different practices, including organic.
Well, in the first half of the book, I really want to set up the challenge that we have, that we face. I call it the gauntlet that we're going to have to run through between now and 2050. And it's a very sobering trip. But in the last half of the book, I really want to point out the things that we can do with the current technology we have right at our fingertips and the current policies that we could implement to really ease this crisis and make it a lot better for all millions more people that are going to be on the planet over the next 35 to 40 years. So a few of those things are we can close our yield gaps, right? The United States and Europe and Australia and China, we have phenomenally high yields, the highest in the world. Many other countries have great soils. They have the potential for irrigation. They have abysmal yields. And with better seeds, of course, better nutrients, better agronomy, we can help those countries increase their yields so that they are producing more for their own people as well as potentially for export. So closing yield gaps in places like Sub-Saharan Africa or one of the areas I visited, Ukraine, which we all is in the news today because the crazy fighting that's going on there. Ukraine is an agricultural powerhouse. It has some of the richest soils in the world. It has long been Europe's historic grain basket. If they can just get their political house in order, they could be a primary supplier of grain to the world, as could Kazakhstan, as could Russia itself, if they would just start to focus on producing food instead of producing oil and gas.
Let me break in here, though, for a minute, because You also talk in the book about how traditional agriculture, or let's say industrial agriculture, depletes soils, and that yields have gone down, that the Green Revolution is not panning out, as you've just said. If they adopt those practices, isn't that just postponing, disaster?
Well, there are ways we can certainly do that, use these Green Revolution inputs a lot smarter than we're currently doing. I mean, half of our fertilizer just gets washed into our waterways. It's completely wasted. One of the great things that I love about the organic agriculture movement is that organic growers are really practicing very good agronomy. Their focus is on the soil. Like the Green Revolution, everyone's focus is on the seed. What does the seed need? We need to make sure there are no limiting factors in that seed. So we have to provide it with water. We have to provide it with nutrients. We have to provide it with everything. We have to protect it from pests. So everything, is all around the seed. And of course, the organic production model flips that on its head. It said, no, we have to provide healthy soils. We have to provide fertile soils full of organic matter, full of worms, full of bacteria, full of, a living soil that will help create healthier plants that can resist drought, that can resist insect attack. And this is, people used to think organic agriculture was sort of like going back to the dibble stick, going back to our grandfather's form of agriculture. It's not. What they're doing now is really, as one researcher from Cornell told me, it's postmodern agriculture. We're really looking at the relationship between the soil, flora, and fauna and the roots of the plants that we most want to cultivate and trying to figure out, what is the best fungi? What is the best bacteria? What can we do to promote this seed growth? And we've seen it work out. One of the examples that you were alluding to was this system of rice intensification. Now, this has been around for a while. It was started in Madagascar by a Jesuit priest who was from France, who was observing the peasants grow rice in a way that he'd never seen rice produced before. And he thought, they really are doing quite well with this type of technique. What if we blended a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and came up with a new type of rice production, which they did. This new type of agronomy of growing rice, and essentially they're transplanting very tiny seedlings in large spaces that allow this tremendous root growth to occur that makes the plant very stable and also tends to yield 2 to 3 times what a conventional rice production will do, is now going sweeping throughout the rice growing areas of the world. And only a few years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, a very poor farmer from the state of Bihar, which is the poorest state in India, used this method, and it was kind of a blend of the old and the new. So he used the system of rice intensification agronomy, plant spacing, seedling, weeding, and only keeping the water, the field fairly moist, not flooding it like traditional rice production is done. But he also used high-yielding seeds. He used a smattering of fertilizer, just a little bit, as well as organic manures and green manure crops that he plowed in before he planted. And he was able to shatter the rice yield record that year. Now, they had a great year, no doubt. The rains came, the monsoons did what they were supposed to do. But the previous record was something like 16 tons of rice per hectare, enormous amount in anybody's book. And this young farmer hit 22 tons of rice per hectare. So to me, it just was a great example of showing what we can achieve if we use the best of both worlds. If we don't sort of hold our nose and say, don't do that, we can't use that. But if we kind of take the best of all of the agronomy that we see going on around the world and blend it into this new type of agriculture that is both good for the environment, good for the soils, good for our water tables and our water quality, and also good for yields. And I think it can be done. The SRI rice uses half the water, very little fertilizer, and typically produces 2 to 3 times the yield. Now, it takes a little more labor, it takes a little more management, but that's a small price to pay for what you get out in the end.
And it costs a lot less.
And it costs an enormously much less to produce than conventional rice. And when I asked one of the rice researchers in Punjab who was helping farmers get into this, I said, why isn't the Punjab Agricultural University promoting this? Why isn't the International Rice Research Institute promoting this? And his point was, they didn't invent it. There are no papers to write. There's no new product to spray. It benefits no one but the poor farmer. and therefore they have no interest in it. And that was a bit cynical, but I thought, you know what, maybe there's a point there. If so much of our agriculture is geared towards selling the farmer something, you know, selling him a very expensive seed, selling him a very expensive chemical that's going to either fertilizer or pesticide. And a lot of economies are based on that. And those companies are very powerful. So upsetting the apple cart and doing it a way that's both cheaper and more productive is not often in the big company's best interests.
This is a great place, Joel Bourne, to talk about GMOs, genetic engineering of food crops. You have a very nuanced discussion in The End of Plenty, your book, about GMOs. And the lesson that I took away from it is that the problem is not so much genetic engineering per se, but the business model of genetic engineering. For example, you give the examples of golden rice that is high in vitamin A, versus the example of Roundup Ready crops that are creating a huge problem of superweeds. So I wonder if you could talk about those two ways of thinking about genetically modified seeds.
Yeah, when I was at NC State in the early 1980s, this is just when genetic technology took off. We called them transgenics back then. And my plant breeding professor was just beside himself. These were going to be the miracle crops. We were finally going to be able to do what Borlaug had long dreamed and take rhizomes off of a soy plant or a peanut plant, graft them onto the roots of a corn plant or a rice plant or a wheat plant, and never have to fertilize those crops again. Or we would be able to imbue these crops with vaccines that would cure common diseases. Vaccines that were actually grown by the crop themselves. Same with nutrient deficiencies. We're going to be able to now create super nutritious crops that we're going to be able to wipe this scourge of nutrient deficiency off the planet. And here we are, 35 years later, and what do we got? We got two blockbuster traits, Roundup Ready or Roundup Resistance, glyphosate resistance, and we've got the BT transgene. The soil bacteria that is effective against some Lepidoptera insects. And it's like I tell people, GMOs as currently practiced today remind me of that great, hair band in the 1980s that had two good songs, and they kept playing them over and over and over again. So here we are now 35 years later, or well, 15 years later since the first GMOs came out, and we're starting to see enormous resistant weeds to Roundup. In almost every state in the United States, we're seeing important insect pests starting to be resistant to the BT transgene. So they're constantly have to shifting the proteins in the BT. The weed resistance has gotten so bad that companies like Monsanto and Syngenta are starting to develop their next generation of GM crops are going to be resistant to things like 2,4-D. Dicamba, things that chemicals that we invented in the 1950s and 60s I'd hope by now we were getting away from. And now they're bringing these old granddaddy, much more toxic chemicals back into the farm system. If they replace Roundup, which is the, best-selling chemical in the world, it's already in our rain, it's in our waterways, it's become a global contaminant. And if we start replacing that with things that are much more toxic, it's just going backwards, in my opinion. So one of the things that I found that was so surprising to me in this book is that since the blockbuster GMO crops came out in the early 1990s, there has not been a single new, safer chemical herbicide mode of action developed by any of the chemical companies. They just stopped trying. They saw such an enormous money incentive in creating things like Roundup Ready seeds that they basically stopped working on all these other types of safer classes of chemicals. And that's that's just a real shame. But the good news is the price of this technology, which used to be extraordinarily expensive, is now becoming very cheap because of our incredible computing power. So now you can sequence a gene, a plant genome, on a computer with only a little more powerful than the iPhone you got in your pocket. It costs you $99, takes about a week. And, that's an incredible asset to researchers who are working at land-grant universities, some of whom I interviewed for this book. One of them, Pam Ronald at UC Davis, use the technology to create a rice that can withstand being submerged for almost 2 weeks. Now, most people think, well, rice stays submerged, doesn't it? Well, no. Rice is one of these plants that likes to have its feet wet, but if it gets completely submerged, it dies very quickly. But if you can create one that can, you know, hold its breath for 2 weeks, this is an incredible boon to farmers in South Asia who farm in floodplains, in very flood-prone areas, of which, you know, most rice in the world is grown in these huge deltas, the Mekong and the Indus, which are typically prone to flooding. So that was an enormous benefit. Also, we saw the Golden Rice Initiative, which has been very controversial. Many groups are very much opposed to it. But again, this is something that was derived with patents from the big companies. But it has the potential to really, if not completely wipe out, incredibly diminish the vitamin A deficiency around the world, which causes blindness and death and you know, enormous host of ills in many of the poorest countries of the world. So, you know, finally, some of these things are come to fruition that are actually starting to show some benefit for real people, poor farmers around the world. And even though the new, you know, the Roundup Ready transgene and the BT transgene haven't caused the great environmental damage or the great health crisis that we thought were going to occur, and they have done some good, I'll admit, by reducing the amount of more toxic pesticides we used to spray on cotton. And of course, Roundup is much more benign than some of the herbicides that we used in the past. So there have been some benefits in those cases. But really, the challenge in front of us, I think, is too great and too dire for us to take such a powerful technology and just sort of put it on the shelf, hold our nose and say, no, we're not going to use it. We have been manipulating genes in our food since we began farming. You know, we have, I use the example of my Labrador Retriever. You know, it's the reason it's a very gentle pet that lives in my house instead of a wolf is because we've bred it and inbred it for eons to make it that way we wanted it. So our manipulation of the natural world has been going a long time, and it will continue. But because these things produce pollen, because these things have the ability to self-replicate and spread widely with the wind, we have to be very careful about which ones we allow farmers to plant. And I think, you know, opening up that process to peer review, to allow other researchers to study it and make sure that nothing comes out that's going to be harmful to both either people or the environment is critical if that technology is actually going to be beneficial. Because otherwise, people are just not going to trust it. And they're not going to want to eat it. They're not going to want it in their fields. And I wouldn't blame them.
Maybe we need a kind of prevention, you know, proving that a product is safe before it's used rather than afterward, because even glyphosate, which, as you point out, is safer than 2,4-D, there have been increasing studies that are showing that it, too, has some major health effects.
Well, and this is the great danger. I mean, if suddenly we find out next year that glyphosate is the next DDT, you know, if suddenly we're starting to see endocrine disruption coming from glyphosate, and now it's, like I said, it's ubiquitous. It's the USGS a couple of years ago sampled it and found it in our rain, you know, so it's on almost every water body in every bread basket around the world. It is ubiquitous, and it would be tragic if somehow all the dissenting voices who did the studies that showed there were some things to worry about with glyphosate, who were immediately laughed out of the room or hushed up, suddenly were proven right at the expense of the health of the world. I hope that's not the case, but I think you're absolutely right. In order for the public to have some side of security and surety and confidence in that these crops will do no harm, there needs to be an open and honest registration process that's not based on company data. Now, you know, all these studies that are used to get FDA approval are deemed proprietary at the moment. They're done under contract by the companies, for the companies. They are not allowed to be peer reviewed. And I don't think that's the best way to go. I think we have to come up with a way that both protects their intellectual property rights, but also gives people confidence that these aren't just things done for the company to pass certain muster. Otherwise, I think we are going to be severely limited into what we can do with them.
So finally, in the minute we have left, I'd like to ask you, Joel Born, what gives you the greatest hope, if any, that we can turn this around in time?
Oh, you know, I'm very positive about our future. Honestly, I know there's a challenge in front of us, but I think humanity. I liken this, and I've told friends that I think humanity is sort of like the old mule that keeps plodding along in its traces and keeps going and going until he either gets to the end of the road that he's plowing, or somebody jerks his reins and turns around in a different direction. And I think climate change and these food price crises is the wake-up call for the world. I think it's someone jerking at our reins and telling us we need to go in a different direction. And every time we've been in this point, either scientists or farmers or consumers have risen to the challenge. You know, there's no guarantee, there's no law that says we have to hit 9.6 billion people in 2050. There's no law that says we have to double our food consumption. You know, we can educate girls in the developing world, start a pink revolution there. Because if you simply educate girls to the sixth grade, you know, they almost invariably have fewer children. There's no need for sub-Saharan Africa to triple its population in the next century. You know, we educate girls, we liberate girls, we give women farmers the same rights that men farmers have. We eat less meat. You know, there are so many things that we can do. We can certainly stop throwing grain away in our fuel tanks or our vehicles. There's so many much more efficient ways to move ourselves around than that. So I really think that using these price signals and these scary challenges with climate change, these climate shocks, will really make people sit up and think and say, you know what, it's time we need to do something different. And when I speak about these issues at college campuses, I see these young people who are going into life sciences or either going into remote education fields, you know, doing things that are so good for the planet and for the people that live here. I'm absolutely confident we can defeat this. The biggest hurdle is going to be climate change. And as, you know, we saw in the Republican debate last night, there are still people who are not willing to address that issue. I don't think that's going to last much longer. I think we're, you know, a couple more climate shocks, a couple more price shocks, and even Republican presidential candidates are going to realize that climate is something that we need to address, and we ignore it at our peril. We really do.
And they'll be more likely to do that if they read your excellent book, The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel Born, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation about it.
No, Francesca, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for taking on this important issue.
Joel Born. Read an excerpt from The End of Plenty by going to writersvoice.net. And while you're there, weigh in with your opinion on the food crisis. Missed a part of today's show or just want to hear it again? Get our free podcast on iTunes or any podcast app, or sign up for our weekly newsletter and get the show delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for joining us this hour. We'll see you next week when we talk with novelist Joyce Carol Oates and Michael Golding. Writer's Voice, as ever, thanks our magnificent webmaster, Bill Way, and you, our devoted listeners. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.